Okay, welcome everybody. Today is Friday, November 11th, 2022, and welcome to another Friday edition webinar. And thanks everybody for joining me. First, just a couple things. Yesterday, we posted a podcast with a German young man named Marvin Haberland, and I hope everybody checks that out. He's an engineer from Hamburg who knows a lot about virology, and he decided to get himself fined for not wearing a mask, and that allowed him entrance into the German court system, and he is basically contesting the fine based on the fact that the virologists do not follow the scientific method, and that is required by law, and that's the basis of his case. And one of the reasons I wanted to interview him, not only to allow him to explain what the case was about, but to do a little bit of questioning of him so that he would be prepared if in fact he gets cross-examined, which if the case actually goes on, I think he would. I'm not sure I did a great job of cross-examining him. I was probably too nice and too friendly. But anyways, hopefully it helped for him to hear some of the questions. And it was pretty easy for him to answer all the questions, so he doesn't need me to prepare for this. So that was good. The other thing is next week, we're going to post a short podcast interview I did with Mike Stone from Virology, who did a piece called Gain of Fiction, which is where I got the title of this talk from, or this webinar. So I hope everybody tunes into that. And that will be going over a deeper look at some of the scientific papers, so-called scientific papers, especially this recent Boston lab paper that's so much in the news now about the scary gain of function virus that was created in this Boston lab. So for those of you who want a deeper dive into this gain of fiction story, please check out his website and see the entire article called Gain of Fiction. There it is in the chat. And you can tune into the podcast, which we will post next week. And I don't know of any other announcements. The plan for next week is to do a webinar on Wednesday and probably not on Friday, but I will announce that on Friday. So today I wanted to take a look at this, what is generally called gain of function, which we're calling gain of fiction. And just to be as clear as I can about what we're talking about here, and let's just say my and others' criticism. I would also say another place to look is Mark Bailey's Farewell to Virology paper. He took a look at the gain of function stuff, and Sam and Mark, I believe together, maybe just Sam Bailey, did a piece, one of their videos, specifically on gain of function. So those of you who want to go deeper into this, those are some places to look. And just to be clear here what I'm talking about, because what I am talking about very specifically is the idea that in these gain of function experiments, this gain of function work, or so-called gain of function work, what has been created is a laboratory created infectious virus, which is more lethal, supposedly, than it would have been otherwise. So I'm not arguing against that there are virology laboratories all over the world doing experiments which may end up producing toxic products. That, in fact, is essentially the definition of a vaccine. So they've been doing this kind of experimentation for 70 years of using cell cultures and other types of virology techniques to create toxic products, which then get injected to people. That's not my issue. Nor am I saying that this, what they're doing are, say, worthwhile experiments. That's not my conclusion either. They're not doing worthwhile experiments. But my issue is they're not creating an infectious, more virulent form of a virus. That's it. And that's what the, quote, other side, the people who are espousing this gain of function, lab leaked virus story are claiming. So they're claiming they're creating a more virulent virus. And what we're claiming, and specifically I'm claiming, is there is actually no evidence for that. And all the evidence points to the fact that A, this has not been done, and B, it's not even possible. And again, there's other people who've gone deeper into the actual papers, which I'm not going to do today, because I want to make this into a more general comments and then play one clip that shows how some of the people who are espousing this theory actually have presented it, and hopefully to demonstrate that what they're saying can't possibly be the case. So I wanted to start this by talking about what we mean by a surrogate test. And this is obviously something that I've talked about before, but this is a very important part of understanding this story. Because all of the tests in virology would be considered surrogate tests, or their surrogate approaches to proving the existence and the makeup and the morphology and the composition and the infectivity of the so-called virus. So let me explain what I mean by that and why this is such a huge problem for virology. So in science and medicine, particularly when you're doing diagnostic tests or tests to demonstrate something in medicine, you go through a process of finding what is generally called the gold standard. And that means something that is generally accepted, I would even say widely, and I might even say universally accepted as being true. And that can then anchor your search for a surrogate marker. And I would submit that unless you can come up with a gold standard and actually demonstrate that the gold standard is undeniably true, that every single surrogate test should be questionable at best and invalid at worst. So what do I mean by that? So let's take a very simple example that I've used before, which is pregnancy. So you have a woman, because as far as we know, only women get pregnant. And the woman starts to, her belly, abdomen starts to enlarge. And let's say they're 5, 6, 7 months pregnant, and you're wondering if there's a baby in there. Now, the gold standard can't be an enlarging abdomen, because obviously women and men get enlarging abdomens for many other reasons. Sometimes they're just getting fat, sometimes they have a tumor, or they could have edema, or they could have swallowed a basketball, or whole lots of other reasons. So that's not the gold standard. But in this case, the gold standard could be you feel the movement of the baby, you hear the heartbeat, and then you do an ultrasound to confirm that, in fact, there is a baby inside this woman's abdomen, specifically the uterus. Now, I would also point out that you could be fooled by that. You could hear a heartbeat, but it could actually be an aorta, abdominal aortic aneurysm that has a loud pulse. So you have to be careful about that. You could feel movement, but that could even be gas. So you have to be careful about that. You could say an ultrasound, and you could demonstrate the different parts of the fetus. And then you have to ask what even sounds like a ridiculous question, but are you sure that the high intensity sound waves that you're using in an ultrasound didn't create the fetus? Now, I would say that's actually kind of absurd, because there's no way that that could happen. But even that sort of questioning should happen. But if you do all those things, and you can absolutely say this woman has a fetus inside her abdomen, specifically the uterus, and the rest of the women, they don't, or the men, they don't. Somebody even suggested when I went through this that the only real gold standard for being pregnant, having a fetus inside your abdomen, is when the baby comes out, because then you know for sure. But let's say an ultrasound and hearing the heartbeat and feeling movement, that's a pretty good gold standard. You can say that is true, that means there's a baby. Then you can do a surrogate test, like test for, you know, beta HCG, a protein or marker in the blood. And then you have to calibrate it. So above a certain amount means you're pregnant, and below a certain amount means you're not pregnant. And then you have to run 100 women who you know are pregnant and see if you can find the cutoff, and see what percentage of those women who you know are pregnant actually have a positive test. And let's say you have 100 women you know are pregnant and 97 of them test positive. That tells you the error rate, which is 3%, are false negatives. And then you can use that test in, you know, medical clinical situations. And you will also know that if you get a negative test, 3% of those people, given the situation, may in fact be pregnant. And that's what we mean by a validated test against a gold standard. You also have to do the other side, which is you can run the test on 100 men, none of whom are pregnant. And if you get 3 of them are positive, that is to say, their levels are over the marker level, the cutoff level, you then know that you have a 3% false positive rate, because there are other things that can cause an elevation of HCG, maybe a tumor, maybe some other inflammation. And so it's possible that some women, and maybe even some men, might have that elevation over the cutoff. But you know what the error rate is by doing studies, which are validation studies, and then you know the false positive rate, and then and only then can you use the test. If you've never done these validation studies, the test is meaningless, because you don't know how accurate and how specific the test is. The problem of virology is the only gold standard which anybody could possibly agree with would be having people with the same symptoms, finding in their biological fluids the same particle that comes out in a ultra centrifuge band, and then you would then isolate, i.e. purify the particle, you could show that each of those particles have the same morphology on an electron microscope. They're all made of the same proteins. They all have the same sequence of genetic material. And when purified and then exposed to an otherwise healthy person, they would cause the same symptoms as the original people. And then you could repurify the virus from them. So that would be a gold standard for virology. And then, and only then, could you do surrogate tests that would substitute for this gold standard. The reason you do surrogate tests, obviously, is because it's easier to do a blood test or a urine test for pregnancy than it is to palpate and listen to the heartbeat and do an ultrasound, and they used to even do x-rays to validate it. So you want an easier way, and that's fine to have an easier way, i.e. a surrogate test, but only if you validate it against a gold standard. Now, virology's fundamental mistake was they considered the cell culture to be the gold standard. And again, I showed this on Wednesday, but if you just look at Stefan's experiment and the conclusion, you see the final words that the studies have clearly shown that syncytia formation is not specific for measles infection, i.e. for a virus. Thus, the forgotten observations of Enders and Peebles and Beck and von Magnus have confirmed that Enders and Peebles' successors proving the existence of a virus with the technique, otherwise what they're referring to is the cell culture, was only an assumption. So in other words, the cell culture itself is a surrogate test. The genome is a surrogate test. The PCR is a surrogate test. Finding an antigen with lateral flow is a surrogate test. Finding antibodies is a surrogate test. None of them have ever been validated against a gold standard, meaning they found, i.e. isolated, purified, characterized, and shown that it was infectious virus. Therefore, they are all invalid, and none of them could possibly prove the existence of the virus. Now, here's another study, which I've probably shown at some point. Sorry. This was by the Perth group and Eleni Papadopoulos Eliopoulos. The isolation of HIV, has it really been achieved? The case against. And what you read in here is this is 15, 20 pages of dissecting every surrogate test that has been used to purport that HIV exists, and show that in every single case, meaning every single case, the surrogate test does not prove the existence of a virus, because it never can. And then in every single case, they demonstrate that there is a perfectly reasonable explanation for why you're finding these kind of sequences, why you get this kind of antibody reaction, why you find these proteins that band at this density, why you see these pictures on an electron microscope. None of them actually can prove or has proven that they can only arise because of the existence of this particle called HIV. So she and they systematically debunked every possible surrogate test that has been done. And at the end of the article, you have no choice but to conclude that none of the surrogate tests prove the existence of HIV. And since only surrogate tests have been used, there is no scientific evidence that HIV exists. So with that background, Let's then look at what people are saying about this gain of function, and I will stop along the way. Okay, so to be fair, let me just restart this because I'm not sure I pushed the sound. I didn't. So I have to share the sound. Sorry about that. Okay, now to be fair, this was an interview that was conducted maybe a year ago. And so, like all of us, possibly we change our tune. But the reason this I wanted to play this is one of the most important interviews about this gain of function. And this gain of function has been the subject of movies. You know, the Plandemic movie was based on this. And I'm not saying now that this whole COVID story wasn't planned and executed by certain people. I'm only talking about proving the existence of this lab-leaked so-called gain-of-function virus. Then we go on, and this has been a prominent story now for 3 years. It's been picked up by Mercola and Kennedy and Fulmic and just about everybody in the freedom movement. And now there's another movie about it. And now we're hearing that we may be locked down again because of the scary Boston gain of function virus that's circulating in the Northeast. So this is still a huge issue, and we need to figure out or need to look at what actually was done and what people prominent in this are actually saying. So let's take a listen.
Presentation. As you know, we have reviewed the over 4,000 patents that have been issued around SARS coronavirus. And we have done a very comprehensive review of the financing of all of the manipulations of coronavirus, which gave rise to SARS as a subclade of the beta coronavirus family.
So let me just stop there. And I think one of my points here is what you're going to hear is not actually science or biology. So there is no attempt, and maybe it's because he doesn't think this is relevant, but there is no attempt to actually prove the existence of the beta coronavirus family. If there is no beta coronavirus family, because these so-called pathogenic viruses don't exist, then already we have a problem.
And so what I wanted to do was give you a quick overview timeline-wise, because we're not going to go through 4,000 patents on this conversation, but I have sent to you and your team a document that is exceptionally important. This was made public in the spring of 2020.
Yes.
This document, which you do have and can be posted in the public record, is quite critical in that we took the reported gene sequence, which was reportedly isolated as a novel coronavirus, indicated as such by the ICTV, the International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses of the World Health Organization. We took the actual genetic sequences that were reportedly novel and reviewed those again.
So again, this is now starting, we're starting too many steps down the road with the assumption that these novel sequences were actually proven to come from a coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2. And so the problem is, if that's not the case, because there is no SARS-CoV-2, then these novel sequences couldn't possibly have come from SARS-CoV-2. And let's go on.
The patent records that were available as of the spring of 2020. And what we found, as you'll see in this report, are over 120 patented pieces of evidence to suggest that the declaration of a novel coronavirus was actually entirely a fallacy. There was no novel coronavirus. There are countless, very subtle modifications of coronavirus sequences that have been uploaded, but there was no single identified novel coronavirus at all. As a matter of fact, we found records in.
And so this is where it starts to get confusing because, okay, so is what he's saying is there is no coronavirus, there is no SARS-CoV-2, in which case, what are we talking about with these novel sequences? And so at that point, people seem to be confused as to what in the heck is really going on here.
The patent records of sequences attributed to novelty going to patents that were sought as early as 1999. So not only was this not a novel anything, it's actually not only not been novel, it's not been novel for over two decades. But let's take a very short and what I'll do is I'll take you on a very short journey through the patent landscape to make sure people understand what happened. But as you know, up until 1999, the topic of coronavirus vis-a-vis the patenting activity around coronavirus was uniquely applied to veterinary sciences. The first vaccine ever patented for coronavirus was actually sought by Pfizer. The application for the first vaccine.
I at this point want to point out there's a difference, and I'm not sure that the people who are espousing these lab leak gain of function virus theory appreciate this. There's a difference between having somebody file a patent for something. I would say that's a political maneuver versus what we're talking about, which is actually proving that this thing exists and can do damage. We're not arguing, or I'm not arguing, that they didn't create patents and they didn't upload different sequences. What we're saying is these things which are meant to harm us, which are infectious, transmissible, scary viruses, they don't exist. And that, unfortunately, is not being dealt with and is not being looked at. And it's not addressed by finding more and more patents. That, unfortunately, I would say, maybe not that's the right word, doesn't prove that anything exists.
Seen for coronavirus, which was specifically this S spike protein. So the exact same thing that allegedly we have rushed into invention. The first application was filed January 28th, 2000. 21 years ago.
Let me say something about the spike protein, the alleged spike protein, because, and I also want to refer everybody to an interview that Stefano Scoglio did with Torsten Engelbrecht, where he points out that there is no evidence at all that any so-called vaccine will result, that's the word, in the formation of spike proteins in the recipient of the vaccine. Not one paper. That's like saying, I'm going to make rubber bands out of rubber. So I have rubber and I have a process of making rubber bands, but I refuse to show you that I can actually make rubber bands out of this rubber. Nobody would believe that it works unless you can show them the rubber bands. And so this spike protein, allegedly from the virus, has never been shown to in any published study, according to Stefano, and he looks into these things very thoroughly, and you can go to that interview to see the evidence. It's never been proven to be made or that a spike protein is part of any virus. And so that's a problem with focusing on patents or information relating to a spike protein, implying that it's part of a virus when that has actually never been demonstrated.
So the idea that we mysteriously stumbled on the way to intervene on vaccines is not only ludicrous, it is incredulous, because Timothy Miller, Sharon Klepfer, Albert Paul Reed, and Elaine Jones on January 28th, 2000, filed what ultimately was issued as U.S. Patent 6372224, which was the spike protein virus, a vaccine for the canine coronavirus, which is actually one of the multiple forms of coronavirus. But as I said, the early work up until 1990.
Again, using the existence of coronavirus as if it's a fact, when in fact that has never been demonstrated. So let's go on.
Presentation.
Whoops.
Ago.
Sorry.
Virus, a vaccine for the canine coronavirus, which is actually one of the multiple forms of coronavirus. But as I said, the early work up until 1999 was largely focused in the area of vaccines for animals. The two animals receiving the most attention were probably Ralph Baric's work on rabbits and the rabbit cardiomyopathy that was associated with significant problems among rabbit breeders, and then canine coronavirus in Pfizer's work to identify how to develop S and spike protein vaccine target candidates, giving rise to the obvious evidence that says that neither the coronavirus concept of a vaccine nor the principle of the coronavirus itself as a pathogen of interest with respect to the spike protein's behavior is anything novel at all. As a matter of fact, it's 22 years old based on patent filings. What's more problematic, and what is actually the most egregious problem, is that Anthony Fauci and NIAID found the malleability of coronavirus to be a potential candidate for HIV vaccines. And so SARS is actually not a natural progression of a zoonotic modification of coronavirus. As a matter of fact, very specifically, in 1999, Anthony Fauci funded research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, specifically to create, and you cannot help but you know, lament what I'm about to read, because this comes directly from a patent application filed on April 19th, 2002, and you heard the date correctly, 2002. Where the NIAID built an infectious replication defective coronavirus that was specifically targeted for human lung.
So this is the most important sentence in this whole presentation, and I am not going to show the whole interview, obviously. So they said, he said they built in 2002, and presumably this is because of a combination of sequences from HIV being downloaded into the coronavirus. And this is what led to my question that I will announce the winner of today, What do you get when you cross a unicorn with a rhinopotamus? Rhinopotamus. So they crossed an HIV or downloaded or inserted sequences from an HIV into a coronavirus. And again, for those of you who still don't know that there is no such thing as HIV, please read Elena Papadopoulos Eliopoulos's paper that I referred to. But what they got, he said, and I'll play it again, is they built an infectious replication defective coronavirus. Let me play that again.
Replication defective coronavirus, where the NIAID built an infectious replication defective coronavirus.
Right. So the problem with that is the definition of a virus, or any virus, but certainly a pathogenic virus, is an infectious replication competent piece of protein with genetic material. If they built, which I don't think they did, but let's just say for a minute that they in fact could have built a infectious replication defective coronavirus, they built nothing. If it's replication defective, it doesn't do anything, and it's not a virus. And I don't know how else to make that clear, but if in fact what he's saying is true, and they report that they built a infectious replication defective virus, they built nothing that should be of any concern to everybody, because if it's replication defective, it won't do anything to anybody, and it's not an infectious particle, period. And that is the most important claim of this whole thing. So let's go on here.
That was specifically targeted for human lung epithelium. In other words, we made SARS.
In fact, if it's a infectious so-called replication defective virus, it can't possibly cause a disease, because the only theory that a virus causes disease is if it replicates in our lungs. And they just said the patent was for a replication defective virus, meaning it was nothing.
And we patented it on April 19th, 2002, before there was ever any alleged outbreak in Asia, which, as you know, followed that by several months.
Proving that it couldn't possibly have been from this particle because it was replication defective. So the illness called SARS must have had some other cause.
That patent, issued as U.S. Patent 7279327, that patent clearly lays out in very specific gene sequencing the fact that we knew that the ACE receptor, the ACE2 binding domain, the S1 spike protein, and other elements of what we have come to know as this scourge pathogen.
Again, the finding of spike proteins, which is not something that naturally occurs in anything, the finding of the ACE2 domain, claiming that those come from a virus or attached to cell receptors, which have ACE2 receptors. These are surrogate markers, which upon careful examination, again, go to Mark's paper, go to Stefano's work, go to Eliana's work, you will see that there is no evidence that any of these actually came from a virus. And now 30 seconds left.
Was not only engineered, but could be synthetically modified in the laboratory using nothing more than gene sequencing technologies, taking computer code and turning it into a pathogen or an intermediate of the pathogen.
And I would contend that you cannot use computer code to make anything real that would be an infectious replication competent piece of protein with genetic material that can make people sick. This has never been demonstrated, nor I would guess will it ever be demonstrated.
And that technology was funded exclusively in the early days as a means by which we could actually harness coronavirus as a vector to distribute HIV vaccine.
So, what do you get when you cross HIV with coronavirus? What do you get when you cross a unicorn with a rhinopotamus? I'll give you that answer in a minute, because the reality is, as he said, you get nothing. Nothing that can make anybody sick. And this has essentially swayed people into thinking that this whole scheme of virology, these whole computer-based in silico techniques, actually make something that can make people sick. And so they miss the whole story, and they spend their time chasing patents, which, as far as we can see, have produced nothing. So here you see another story. This was from Mercola about this, reveals the synthetic origin of SARS-CoV-2 without ever going through how we know, how we have proved that SARS-CoV-2 actually exists. And I won't read this, but this is the summary of the article about how this all happened. And you can see this was picked up in a Defender article by Kennedy and Cooey and somebody named Charles Rixley, talking about the techniques. It's always talking about the techniques and how they change the viral sequence without ever actually going into, let's find this SARS-CoV-2, prove it exists, let's find it, use the gold standard of how you would prove a virus exists, not a cell culture, which is a surrogate marker. And then you can go from there and see if this was actually a mix of HIV, once you prove that exists, and coronaviruses, once you prove that exists, and they never do that. All they say is we have this smoking gun and forensic scientists have found the fingerprints, but it turns out the fingerprints do not match with the actual hand of the perpetrator. So they use all these things about, has the restriction site fingerprint, typical for synthetic viruses, is anomalous in wild coronaviruses, but they never actually demonstrate the existence of anything called a synthetic virus or a coronavirus. And so how can it be a lab assembled virus? And this one recently another player has got into this, and I'll get back to this in a minute. And that, as we know, is Jeffrey Sachs, chair of the Lancet COVID Commission, who says, Barrick's techniques have long been controversial. It's the artist that doesn't sign his name to the painting, the virologist that doesn't put his signature into the virus to let us know whether or not it's emerging naturally or whether it's produced in a laboratory. All of it says there was a big, very risky research agenda underway. So it's not about the science of how we know what virus is what and how you can find the virus and actually prove it exists. It's all about the patents and research and never about the science. And I'll get back to Jeffrey Sachs in a minute because it's important here in this story. But I want to then announce the winner of our challenge. I said the person would get a $25 gift certificate, and we basically sort of all agreed, at least I did. I agreed with myself that the winner is somebody named or with an email of today915. So if you contact us, we would be happy to send you a $25 gift certificate to Dr. Cowan's Garden. And they sent us this article from Popular Mechanics saying there actually were unicorn rhino, I don't know about rhinopotamus, hybrids that existed. They were real and lived with humans, new study says. And this is the picture, obviously a computer-generated picture of a Siberian unicorn that lived alongside our earliest ancestors, according to a new study. And so all I can say is thank you for sending this to me. And it's not just virology that is in the realm of make-believe, because I don't think this thing actually existed. And it was great to see that this way of making stuff up is not unique to virology. So the question that we're left with, which is a sort of interesting question, which I would admit openly, is speculation on my part. But the question on everybody's minds is, why would they or somebody make up this story? Doesn't it make them look bad that they're doing all this research and spending all this money doing this research on creating these lab engineered viruses? Now, just to say, as I've pointed out, it's pretty clear to me that there are no lab engineered viruses, just like there are no natural viruses. And so really all you can conclude is that the government spent a lot of money and funded a lot of research to basically do nothing. In other words, the government wasted your and my money. And I don't know about you, but that is hardly a stop the presses moment, because with very few exceptions, I don't know anything else the government does do but waste and waste our money and do it on frivolous projects which get nowhere. At least that's the best thing they do. The worst thing is worse than that. So one could say that's what we found. The government and the people they're funding and all these researchers and Fauci are making stuff which does nothing to people and just serves to scare the people and keep them wedded to this virus story. So that was my conclusion until I read the follow-up paper from our friend Jeffrey Sachs. So Jeffrey, as you know, is somebody that I've known for most of my life a little bit, not very well, for the last 40 years. And he is a deep insider. And he wrote a follow-up paper, and he presented the following question, which I think gets to the heart of this matter, which is, what are we going to do about all these government agencies, the NIAID and NIH and CDC and laboratories all over the world, in Wuhan and France and in the United States? What are we going to do about all this research? And now in Boston, Boston was the final straw for the lab-created viral people, because now they created a dangerous and deadly and scary new virus. We have to stop this from going on. We have to nip this in the bud. We cannot let this go on. So Jeffrey posed that question. What should we do about this? And I would ask the question in a slightly different way. Who should regulate this and make sure this never happens again? Who should do this? Who should be the responsible party in this? The party that we can all trust to make sure that this kind of research creating these deadly, scary plague viruses never happens again. Who? Obviously, his answer was, well, who? Yes, who? The World Health Organization, otherwise known as WHO. So, in other words, the solution to the fact that it's obvious that private labs can't police themselves. Look what they did. They made these viruses. It's obvious that Fauci can't police the labs. In fact, he's in on the gambit, so he funds them. We can't trust him. We can't trust the NIH. We can't trust the CDC. They all lied. They all funded this research. They all were guilty of creating this virus that is plaguing the world. We need somebody that we can trust. And he proposed that it could only be the World Health Organization. And therefore, from now on, if this happens, which I don't know if it will, but all virology research essentially should be scrutinized by the World Health Organization and maybe all eventual scientific research. They're the only party that's impartial, fair, et cetera. They can be the ones who regulate this. And if you buy that, I have some stuff to sell you because this is actually ridiculous. And so in a funny sort of way, all of the people who've been proponents of this engineered lab leak virus, they got duped. So that you can see the outcome of this, as revealed by Jeffrey, was, well, now we have to put all of the research into the World Health Organization. They and the World Economic Forum councils, et cetera. Obviously, that's the only solution to get us out of this. And so everybody got played who believes this. They were unwitting, hopefully, proponents of this theory, which does not follow the science, is not scientifically valid. There is no HIV. There is no family of beta coronaviruses. There is no SARS-1, SARS-2, at any other SARS virus. There's no virus, not specifically, there's no illness. That's a whole different story. And so none of that was real. All it was a bunch of government and privately funded patents. And this got picked up by everybody, by politicians, lawyers, et cetera. And they somehow then claim that if we just get these perpetrators in jail, somehow that will end it. And Fauci, et cetera, is not going to jail. This is like the story of Charlie Brown and Lucy putting the football down. And Charlie, every time, thinks, this time it's going to happen. I'm going to kick the football. And of course, she pulls the football away. And this time we're going to get these bad guys and put them in jail. And we're going to throw Fauci in jail. And that never happens. And we keep kicking an empty football. And that's why I decided to weigh in on this. I can't prove that that's what happened, but we can demonstrate that the whole lab leak thing is not based on creating a new lab leaked scary virus. It's based on anti-scientific nonsense. So thank everybody for joining me. I hope you look into it. Never believe me or anybody else. But look into the story yourself. Read the articles by Eliana. Read Mark's. Read Sam and Mark's video on the lab-created gain-of-function stuff and see for yourself. So I hope everybody has a great weekend, and I will see you next Wednesday.